am the Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Hello again, my friend. Last time I told you about Marcion of Sinope, a wealthy shipowner from the Black Sea coast who decided with considerable nerve and his own money to sit down and define exactly which writings deserve to be called scripture. He got excommunicated for it. But here is the thing I always find quietly amusing. His challenge forced the Orthodox Church to respond, to actually build their own canon. He lost the argument. But the Bible, in the form you know it, exists partly because of him. Marcion tried to fix the faith by trimming it, by deciding what counted and what didn't. Today I want to tell you about people who did something entirely different, who received something precious and simply held it, carefully, faithfully, for 15 centuries in a place the rest of the Christian world didn't even know to look. I was there when it began. I watched it pass from hand to hand across generations, and I was watching with very great interest when a group of Portuguese sailors stepped ashore on the Malabar coast of India in 1498 and got the shock of their lives. They were expecting pagans. They found Christians. That moment, that collision of astonishment, is where today's story lives. Stay with me. I want you to imagine a ship. It is 1498, Portuguese, heavy with ambition and the smell of salt and tar and men who have been at sea for months. It rounds the southern tip of Africa and turns northeast, following a coast nobody on board has ever seen. The captain's name is Vasco da Gama. He is looking for spices and souls. In roughly that order. I watched that ship. I had been watching Portugal for a long time by then. I knew what was in the hold, and I knew what was in the hearts of the men on deck. They carried a Christianity forged in the Reconquista, centuries of war against Islam on the Iberian Peninsula, a faith sharpened into a weapon, absolute in its certainty that it was bringing light into darkness. They fully expected to find darkness. That was the whole point. What they found instead stopped them cold. On the Malabar coast of India, in the humid, fragrant, impossibly green southwest corner of the subcontinent, there were Christians, not new ones. Not converts, people whose families had been Christians since before Portugal existed as a nation, since before the Catholic Church had a pope who wielded political power, since before Constantine looked at the sky before battle and saw a cross. Honestly, my friend, you have to believe this. They were Christians, praying in churches before the book or Revelations was written. Think about that. Christians before there was a Bible. I want you to feel the weight of that for a moment. While Rome was building its cathedrals and fighting its crusades and excommunicating its Marcions, these people were here, praying, gathering, passing the faith to their children like a lamp carried carefully through the dark. They called themselves Nasrani, Nazarenes. They prayed in Syriac, a language close cousin to the Aramaic that Thomas himself spoke. They knew the name of their founder. They knew which coast he had walked, which families he had visited, which well he had prayed beside. I knew all of this. I had been watching them the entire time. And when those Portuguese sailors finally encountered them, when the astonishment broke across their faces like dawn, I felt something I can only describe as deep, quiet satisfaction. You see, I wanted to say, you were never the only ones. The church you are about to meet was not waiting to be discovered. It was simply continuing, as it always had, as it always would. Let me take you back further. All the way back to the beginning of this particular thread. The year is 52 AD. The coast of Kerala on the southwestern tip of India. A place the Romans called Muziris. A port city so wealthy, so busy with the spice trade that Roman coins have been found there by the thousands. Pepper, cardamom, cinnamon. The ancient world wanted what this coast produced, and ships came from Egypt, from Arabia, from Persia, following the monsoon winds with the reliability of clockwork. I watched those trade routes for centuries. I knew that coast well. What I did not expect, and I say this with full awareness of how much I have seen, was Thomas. He was one of the 12 closest companions of Jesus of Nazareth. You probably know him best as the doubter, the one who needed to touch the wounds before he could believe. I always thought that reputation was a little unfair. In my experience, the ones who need to be certain before they commit tend to commit most completely once they are. And Thomas committed completely. He traveled east, further than any of the others. Following those same trade routes, those same monsoon winds through Persia and on to India. He was not the first Jew to make that journey. There was already a Jewish community settled on the Malabar coast, traders who had been there for generations, people who spoke Aramaic just as Thomas did. He had a natural landing place, a community who would have recognized his language, his references, his stories. I watched him arrive. I watched the conversations begin. He founded 7 churches along that coast, 7 specific communities in 7 specific places with names that still exist today. Kodungallur, Palayur, Niranam, Kolam, real towns, real congregations. And one of them, the church at Palayur, where tradition says Thomas prayed beside a Brahmin well and converted families who had never heard the name of Jesus. That church is still there, still standing, still gathering. You can visit it. You can put your hand on its stones. I find that almost unbearably moving, if I am honest with you. The community Thomas left behind called themselves Nasrani, Nazarenes. They prayed in Syriac, the liturgical language of the Church of the East, rooted in the same Aramaic world Thomas came from. They were not isolated outcasts. They were traders, landowners, respected members of Kerala society, protected by local kings who valued their commercial networks and their reputation for integrity. They wore the sacred thread of the Brahmin. They spoke Malayalam. They were fully, completely Indian and fully, completely Christian. I watched Rome rise and fall and rise again across those same centuries. I watched councils convene and creeds get written and emperors convert and crusades get launched. I watched the whole enormous machinery of Western Christianity grind forward across 1,000 years. And the entire time in Kerala, these people were simply continuing. Quietly, faithfully, without an army, without a pope, without anyone in the wider Christian world even knowing they were there. I knew. I was watching both. I want you to understand what Thomas was carrying when he stepped off that boat. He was not carrying an institution. There was no institution yet. He was not carrying a canon of scripture. Those arguments were still a century away. He was not carrying a creed or a hierarchy or a set of approved rituals. The Council of Nicaea was nearly 300 years in the future. The first pope to command armies hadn't been born yet. None of that existed. What Thomas carried was simpler than any of that, and harder. He carried the memory of a person, a teacher he had walked with, eaten with, argued with, doubted, and ultimately followed to the edge of everything he knew. He carried stories. He carried a way of seeing the world, the poor as dignified, the outcast as beloved, the stranger as neighbor, the divine as somehow present in the most ordinary human moments. He carried a conviction so alive in him that it had survived his own doubt, survived the crucifixion, survived everything that should have ended it. That is what he brought to Kerala. Not a religion in the institutional sense, a living flame carried in a human hand. And the people who received it understood exactly what they were being given. I watched those early communities form. I watched the faith move through those first Brahmin families, through the Jewish settlers who recognized something familiar in Thomas's teaching, through the fishermen and the merchants and the farmers along that green, rain-soaked coast. It did not arrive as a foreign imposition. It arrived as an answer to questions people were already asking. It landed in a culture that had its own ancient and sophisticated spiritual tradition. And rather than replacing that culture, it wove itself into it. This is important. Please don't miss this. The Nasrani did not become Roman. They became Christian in the way a Kerala family becomes anything, on their own terms, in their own language, with their own dignity intact. They kept the Syriac liturgy because it connected them to the source, to the world Thomas came from, to the living memory of what he carried. But they lived as Indians, fully, without apology. I have seen faith arrive on the tip of a sword many times. I know what that looks like. It looks like compliance. It looks like resentment, buried under the surface, waiting. It looks like a tradition that persists because people are afraid of what happens if it doesn't. This was not that. What I watched in Kerala was something rarer, a community that held the faith because they loved it, because it had answered something real in them, because it had given them a way of understanding the world that felt in the deepest part of themselves, true. They passed it to their children, not as obligation, but as gift. Generation after generation after generation, the faith had taken root, not in stone, not in institution, in people. And that, my friend, is the only kind of root that truly holds. I have watched a great many things disappear, languages, cities, entire civilizations that burned so brightly, I was certain they would last forever. I have watched ideas that seemed unassailable crumble in a generation. I have watched faiths that commanded empires fade to footnotes. Disappearance, in my experience, is the default condition of human things. Which is why what happened in Kerala astonishes me still. The Church of the East, the great Syriac Christian tradition centered in Persia, had maintained a loose and intermittent connection to the Nasrani across the centuries. Bishops arrived occasionally, sometimes with gaps of generations between them. It was never a reliable lifeline, more of a distant family member who wrote rarely and visited almost never. And in the 14th century, when Tamerlane swept through Mesopotamia, even that thin thread was cut. The Nasrani were alone. No metropolitan bishop for generations, no guidance from the wider church, no council to appeal to, just the community itself and what it carried, and the archdeacon who held authority in the absence of anyone else. I want you to sit with that for a moment. Centuries of isolation. A community maintaining a living faith with no institutional lifeline, no external validation, no way of knowing whether anyone else in the world still believed what they believed. And they continued. The liturgy was still sung in Syriac. The churches were still full. The faith was still passed to the children. The flame that Thomas had carried across the known world, that had survived the fall of the Church of the East, that had survived isolation so complete it might as well have been the far side of the moon, that flame was still burning. I think about what that required. Not heroism in the dramatic sense, not martyrdom or grand gestures, just the ordinary, daily, unglamorous faithfulness of ordinary people who got up every morning and chose to continue, who taught their children, who kept the feast days, who prayed in a language most of them probably didn't fully understand anymore, because that language was the thread connecting them to Thomas. And they were not going to let go of it. That is an extraordinary spiritual contribution to the human story. Not because it is unique to Christianity, it is not. I have seen it in other traditions, in other places, in other centuries. But the Kerala church makes it visible in a way that is almost unbearably clear. It tells us something about what faith actually is at its core. When you strip away everything else, it is not a building, it is not a hierarchy. It is not a canon of approved texts or a set of correct doctrinal positions. Those things have their place. I am not dismissing them. But they are the container, not the content. The content is simpler and fiercer. It is the conviction, held in a human heart and passed to another human heart, that something is true, that the world is a certain way, that the divine is present, that how we treat each other matters infinitely, that the flame is worth carrying even when no one is watching. The Nasrani carried it when no one was watching. And then the Portuguese sailed around Africa and arrived on that coast and walked into a church and heard prayers in Syriac, and the world discovered that the flame had never gone out. I was there for that moment. I have thought about it ever since. What survives, I have learned, is never what the powerful intended to preserve. It is what ordinary people loved enough to carry. Here is something I have noticed across all my centuries of watching. When people talk about how faith spreads, they almost always tell the same story. A powerful center, an organized mission, resources, authority, and if necessary, force. The story of Christianity reaching the corners of the world is largely told that way. And the Portuguese sailors who arrived on the Malabar coast in 1498 were living proof of it. They came with ships and soldiers and papal authority and absolute certainty that they were bringing something the world needed. But the Nasrani were already there, and that simple fact quietly dismantles the assumption. Because Thomas arrived in Kerala with none of those things, no army, no institution, no empire at his back, just the memory of a teacher, alive in him like a coal still warm from the fire. And what he planted took root so deeply that 15 centuries later, when the Portuguese finally showed up expecting darkness, they walked into a church full of people who had been praying longer than Portugal had existed. I want you to sit with what that means. It means the word does not need power to travel. It needs people who have genuinely received it. People in whom it is alive, not as habit, not as cultural inheritance, not as social obligation, but as something they know to be true in the deepest part of themselves. The Nasrani held the Syriac liturgy because it connected them to the source, to Thomas, to the world the faith came from. That was the form. But the content, the living conviction, the daily choice to continue, the flame passed from parent to child, that was something no institution gave them and no institution could take away. This matters today, perhaps more than it has in a long time. We live in a moment when the containers of faith are visibly struggling. Institutions that once commanded unquestioning allegiance are losing their hold. Buildings are emptying. Hierarchies are questioned. And there is a real temptation watching all of that to conclude that faith itself is fading. But I have seen this before. I have watched institutions rise and collapse and rise again. And what I have learned, what the Nasrani taught me across 2,000 years, is that the institution is never the thing itself. It is the vessel. Useful, sometimes beautiful, sometimes necessary, but always secondary to what it carries. What carries is the word. Alive in a human heart, passed to another human heart, not because someone in authority commanded it, not because the social consequences of letting it go were too great, but because it is true, because it answers something real, because the person who holds it cannot imagine putting it down. That is a living faith, and a living faith does not require an empire to sustain it. It requires people who love what they have received enough to pass it on. The Nasrani were those people. For 2,000 years, in the spice-scented air of Kerala, with no one watching and no one validating and no external support to lean on, they were simply those people. The Portuguese came and tried to reshape them, to Latinize them, to fold them into a Christianity that looked and sounded like Rome. And yes, that pressure fractured the community, eventually splitting them into churches that still exist as separate bodies today. That is a sadness I carry. But here is what I also carry. Every single one of those fractured communities still traces itself back to Thomas, still claims that original thread, still knows whose hands first brought the flame to that coast. And in the village of Palayur in Kerala, there is a church that has been standing since Thomas himself walked that ground. Tradition says he prayed there beside a Brahmin well, with families hearing his teacher's name for the very first time. That church is not a museum. It is not a monument behind velvet ropes. It is a living congregation still gathering, still praying, in a place where the thread was first tied 2,000 years ago. You can go there. You can walk through its doors and sit down. You can put your hand on stones that have held this story longer than most nations have existed. I find that almost unbearably moving. Still, after everything I have watched, I want to leave you with something simple. Not a question with an answer. Just something to carry with you for a while. The Nasrani did not think of themselves as doing anything remarkable. I am fairly certain of that. They were not aware of being a spiritual miracle. They were not congratulating themselves on their faithfulness. They were simply living, trading their spices, raising their children, gathering on the appointed days, praying in a language that connected them across centuries to a man who had walked a very long way to bring them something he could not keep to himself. They were ordinary people holding an extraordinary thing. And the holding looked, from the outside, almost entirely like ordinary life. The Nasrani didn't build an empire. They didn't launch a mission. They didn't write theology or argue doctrine or send representatives to councils. They just held what they had faithfully and passed it on. That was enough. That turned out to be everything. Next time I want to tell you about a man who found the living flame in the darkest possible place. His name was John of the Cross, a 16th century Spanish monk who was imprisoned by his own religious order, locked in a cell so small he could barely turn around, given almost nothing to eat, brought out periodically to be flogged in front of his brothers. And in that cell, in that darkness, in that silence that must have felt at times like the silence of abandonment, he wrote some of the most luminous spiritual poetry the world has ever produced. I was there. I watched him in that cell. And what I saw still stays with me. The Nasrani held the flame across 2,000 years of quiet faithfulness. John of the Cross held it in a place where every circumstance of his life was designed, whether intentionally or not, to extinguish it. These are different kinds of courage, but they point, I think, to the same truth. The flame does not go out, not when it is genuinely alive in a person. I cannot wait to tell you that story. But for now, thank you for sitting with me today. Thank you for letting the Nasrani matter to you even a little. For letting Thomas walk that coast again in your imagination. For considering even briefly what you are carrying and whether you are carrying it well. These are not small things. Much love. I am Harmonia. Thank you for listening, dear one. If this episode meant something to you, I'd love it if you'd leave a 5-star rating. It helps more people find their way here. And if you subscribe, you will never miss a thread and share this story with someone you love. One more thing, my friend, look in your episode notes. There's a link there that leads back to our little community. Leave a comment. I promise. I read every one. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike 4.0 International. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.